This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. The amazing Pamela Wolford is here. She is a writer. She's a filmmaker, a performer. Hi, Pamela.
Hello.
So great to be with you. We have to tell everyone, full disclosure, we did this program once and the audio did not work. And it was not our engineer. It was our Zoom. So today, we have another chance. And Grace and Pamela are together again. And it's a good thing. Pamela, I love your laugh. Tell me, what is an immersive media director? That's
one,
you.
Yes, one of the hats that I wear. So right now I'm working on a virtual reality experience. So immersive media is, things like virtual reality, augmented reality, extended reality, mixed reality. These are all, different forms of immersive media. So, for instance, like the virtual reality experience I'm working on right now, it's something in which you would have a headset on, and so you feel as if you were in another world.
I know, but is it not uncomfortable for some people? Reality's hard enough,
well,
but to go another dimension, do people resist it sometime?
No.
Oh.
I mean, it's very enticing.
I see. Well, tell us about the new work you just did at the Baltimore Art Museum. And it was a sold out, a whole floor of Pamela and other photographers. What was that about?
Yeah. So it's five artists in all. It's visual artists and interdisciplinary artists. And they were all Baker Artist Award winners. I am the winner of the Baker Artist Award for this year, 2022, in interdisciplinary arts. And I have a multimedia project up there. It's by the name of Antoine and Me. And it's a new art form that I have founded, it's created. Mm-hmm. And with this first series, I celebrate Black love. And it's called, so the art form is Sound Design Photo Narrations, or SDP Narrations. And what I've done is, I've modeled for these photographs that are taken of me. And then I've written a narrative that goes along with the photographs. And then I perform the narrative.
Oh.
And then there is a whole sound experience that goes along with the narration.
I want to know how a writer like Pamela Wolford one day woke up and said, wait a minute, there's more than the text to this telling a story. Do you remember the day that you got fascinated with this otherworldliness where you realized you can tell a story in more than one way?
Oh, that's interesting. No, I don't remember a day. There's plenty of times in my life where there's been some influence on me in terms of in the literary world where I can remember a moment. But in terms of that expansion, I mean, I've always been a great lover of film. And so that's always, so it seeped in my head. And then when I write, it's very cinematic.
Mm.
And it was very cinematic before I was doing other things. And so I'm visualizing things a certain way, and it's an entire experience for me. And when you read my writing, you'll see that I touch on all of the senses so often. And so that, like, the world of immersive media, and for me, I know that I'm going to go even deeper into it in terms of accessing more senses than are accessed even within immersive media. Because I'm always reaching for the next thing,
Pamela,
in terms of a project.
Oh, Pamela, that's what I love about you. You are always reaching for the next thing. That sums you up entirely. So this is Pamela Wolford. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We love being together. And she's going to read something because she's a writer first.
Yeah, and so
set it up for us.
Certainly. So what I'm going to read is this first piece is the opening to a film I've done, a short art film I've done, and the art film itself is about one of the intense thing about this. There's the bulk of it is. Is me doing a monologue of one 10-minute long sentence. It's very emotional, and it's like a runaway train I'm not going to give you that 10-minute sentence here.
What a good idea!
But I'm going to give you the about a minute of what comes before that sentence, and it tells you a lot about me because it's done from from the point of view of a memoir. But then I'm accessing something much broader than that by the time I get to that runaway train sentence.
May I ask where you got the idea for doing one long breath? Where did you get that? Why?
I mean, I don't know where the idea came from, but I knew that it was right for this particular thing. I nearly cried the evening I voted for the first time in the presidential primaries. It was 1988. I was 20. And I was standing outside at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where I lived on campus. There I was, waiting for my mother to pick me up and drive me to Columbia, Maryland, her hometown, where I was registered to vote. She was running late, and the coming darkness of the evening was enveloping me. It sounds overdone, but that's my memory of it. The darkness holding me close, making sure I didn't allow my fear of missing out on the moment bring me to watery eyes. Memory is a momentous thing. It's how we understand the world and navigate it. It's storytelling at its most private and most profound. It's all there is, really, for everything we know only through the lens of memory. It's murky, fingerprinted translucence. It's not transparent, though we often operate as if it were. I take memories and work to hone their truth. Mm-hmm. I am a storyteller, a writer, filmmaker, producer, and performer. I like to think of my art and any truth it gets at is already being in existence, and I'm curating it. Thinking of it that way gives me a better grasp of what I'm doing and makes my life's work make sense to me. I hold it as a kind of guiding light. And I'll stop there. And so, like, for instance, my upcoming virtual reality experience. So I am the writer, director, producer, and the primary performer. And there are two individuals that are heavily involved in it. And that is the programmer. And then also a gentleman who's doing the 3D animation, the 3D modeling and animation. And I work in partnership with him in terms of, you know, the look of the characters and things. And also, and then with the programmer in terms of the world build, the environment design that I will, you know.
You imagine it and then you attribute, you give people their jobs.
You're having these experiences in this virtual world that are you know, based on 3D modeling and animation, but I use these hyper realistic metahumans so that these animated characters, they're not cartoonish at all. I mean, you can see the wrinkles on their face. You can see, I mean, it is so, and it feels as if you're standing right next to this individual. I mean, it's
a magical, if ever there was magic, this is magic. I'm standing first in line with my ticket in my hand to see this because it, you know, when you're little, you dream of magic. And here, guess what? It's real.
Yeah.
Pamela Wolford does it. And let's go back to you as a writer. I'd love to hear another piece.
All right. Well, so this piece, I was reading an excerpt from a short memoir piece. And today I've decided to read all from my nonfiction. I do fiction as well. But since the last time we spoke, we did all fiction. I'm doing all nonfiction. And this is a piece called My Father with This Illness. And it's about my father who had dementia. It's my late father. And, you know, I think it's something really worthy of speaking about. And I And so the opening to this, I speak about the fact that my father, he had, my experience with my father with dementia was much different than some other people's, luckily, because my father became very, there was a beautiful trust and that he had an appreciation that he had for his family during his dementia. A lot of people have to go through that that more of a, you know, negative outburst. And he was quite the opposite of that. And he appreciated us being there for him during this illness so much. And so everything, you know, most of it was pretty, like, he was accepting of our advice about how, what he should do and when he should do it. But so at the beginning of this illness, the one thing that was me, that it took some time was him to agree that he would not drive. And so, so that's the opening of this. And, so that's what came before this moment in it. But driving is a different story. At some point, I tell him he should not drive, and he disagrees. Early on, my mother thinks he is still okay to drive to three familiar places, and only during the day: church, the barber shop, and the supermarket. Somehow, it becomes an unspoken pact that we'll agree to that for now. One day, he comes home from one of the three places and says, "I don't think I'll drive anymore." I don't ask him why now or what happened. I know what it's like when he drives. He can be hesitant on the road when safety calls for less hesitation, much less hesitation. I ask him to say it again in our jovial way. We joke and smile about most everything, and he does say it again. He is a lawyer, a retired lawyer, and my mother was a legal secretary earlier in her career. Legality is in our blood. I ask him to sign a contract. I smile and ask him. I don't ask for his car keys. I write something like, "I will no longer drive my vehicle or any vehicle," on a scrap of paper. He signs and dates it, and I put it on the refrigerator, where it remains for years to come. My mother and I read about, discover by doing, or learn from medical professionals things we can do in addition to his medication to stave off the progression of his dementia: playing Wii bowling with him and other games, finding books with short self-contained sections like A Book of Legal Lists and Peter Jennings' The Century that he can read sections of without having to remember what he's read days before if he takes a break from the book. And spending time with him, a lot of time, talking, sharing recent stories, reliving memories, singing, my father, the only one of us who can carry a tune, and laughing and going for walks. His doctor tells him to go for walks with me, and I ask the doctor to write him a prescription for it, which I also place on the refrigerator, where it too remains for years to come. And my father then, after the prescription is written and placed there, more readily goes with me on walks. One time, he sings repeatedly one song which I so wish I could remember the name of today. For most of our half-hour walk, he sings it with such joy. In the last 2 years of my father's life, before his death at 81, I move home to help care for him and my mother, who by now has terminal stage cancer, which she will survive. I had been coming home at first one day every week, then three, then I move there. It is a lot. And these two particular illnesses will, by far, not be the worst of their medical plights. I witness each of them suffer in unimaginable ways beyond the cancer and dementia. Theirs is a long story of struggles and miracles and love. stop it there.
Whoa. That is definitely heart connection stuff. That's more than language, isn't it? That's more than language.
Yeah.
Yes, I want everyone to know that you're the author of more than 100 memoir, fiction, human interest, profile, interview, and think pieces. And you've been published in many laudable magazines, including Crisis and the Baltimore Sun and the Hutchins Center Transition at Harvard. You have been prolific in every dimension of the arts, in all of them. You have gone headfirst to consume and immerse yourself. So I see you as a noticer, that every day you are noticing and gathering images, that it is not, you're like a funnel in a way. You just go through life gathering things which you might be able to use on your next piece of paper or your next photograph. So you witness the world, don't you?
I do, but it's not conscious. Like, it's not purposeful. But I have a great emotional memory. And so, like, I can go back in my life to my childhood, and I remember how things felt, and I remember how I can remember my thought processes.
Can you relive the feeling?
Oh, yes, most definitely.
So you can go there.
Yeah, I can go there, and I can have memories, and my emotions will change. I mean, I can feel as
so
if I want to cry, right?
You can occupy that reality.
I definitely occupy that reality.
That is an unusual trait.
Yeah. Or I can laugh out loud at the memory of that good time. It's very strong.
So your database is chock full. Believe me, your database is full.
I don't know what I'd do if I were not an artist.
I wonder what anybody does if they're not an artist.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine not being awake in the world that way, which is essential. I'm going to give you a quiz, and you're going to give me an answer for every one of these accomplishments.
Okay.
I'm just going to rattle them out and see if you remember what you did. So art as a response to anti-blackness. What does that mean?
Okay, so that was a panel discussion that I organized. Okay.
Okay, so what was 20 Years, 20 Poets?
So 20 Years, 20 Poets was an anthology that I headed up the editorial committee for, and it's an anthology of 20 really internationally known poets that that came to my local community over a period of 20 years.
Over 20 years?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, you've got all the Pulitzer Prize winners here. Mm-hmm. Okay, A World of Difference.
So A World of Difference was a multifaceted program. I mean, it was one day on one stage, but it involved not only film screening, but also filming of the actual event that later would become a part of a documentary.
Well, let's just give you a couple more.
Okay.
Okay. And so Dominique Morisot.
Okay. So her play Sunset Baby was done locally in my home county. And we partnered with the Center Stage in Baltimore when Kwame Kwe-Arma was directing there.
Right. And Maryland Jambalaya Fest.
The Maryland Jambalaya Fest was a festival that I directed, and I was the creator of. It was a full day of celebrating people of African descent in a number of different disciplines. And there was museums from all around the state involved that actually had on-site exhibitions, and we had indoor workshops and outdoor celebrations and performances and over 100 vendors.
In one day?
It was all one day.
I bet you slept that night.
Yeah.
And then Jambalaya Magazine, which is something different.
Yes, but that was, it was sort of the same theme, was spotlighting people of African descent. And we had fiction and profiles, and I always did a Q&A, because I was the editor-in-chief of the publication.
You've had 12 film festivals in Europe and America and abroad. And what do you think When you attended those, what do you think people made of them? What do you think changed in people when they saw your work? Here's this, and you were present, right?
I mean, it's not at all of them, uh-huh. but at a number of them.
Do you have any idea the feedback you got? For instance, Sweden, the UK, what do you think they made of them?
It was interesting because that particular film that got a good deal of attention in the film festival circuit, and it won a number of different awards. But it's what I would describe as an avant-garde film. It's hard, you know. I've used the term experimental mm-hmm. film, but you know, oftentimes when you use the term experimental, people think there's not a narrative, and there is always a narrative. I mean, for the most part, in the work that I do. I mean, sometimes if something is based in the physical in terms of the body. I mean, I have a background as a dancer as well and you know, choreograph, you know, on my own body. And so I do movement-based art. But usually even that is coupled with narration because it's always a story that I'm telling so often.
Are you telling the same story over and over? Camus says we always are.
Well, you know, I have not in that sense, in terms of like there's a singular point that I'm always making.
But is there a theme that you see in all your work?
Well, there are times when there is a particular story that will show itself that I actually use almost literally the same story in different forms. There's a story that I've written called Just After Supper, and that was the basis for the double narration in that avant-garde film that we were talking about, Generation. And then you'll also see that referenced in the virtual reality experience as well. I don't know that I'm done with that particular story. It may end up on the stage. It may, in one story, I may reinvent it in different ways.
Oh, and that is very interesting. You're never finished.
Here's hoping.
I can't get enough of this new art forms, and I want to know what the dangers are in being an artist.
Can you be more specific about the question?
Isn't it funny that you don't feel there's danger, or you wouldn't ask that question?
Well, that's true.
the difference between art and craft is risk. You're taking huge risks every minute to break new ground and to do something that could be make people uncomfortable because they're not used to it. Someone could resist it, someone could judge it, but none of that occurs to you, does it?
Well, for me, that's the same as just being alive because I mean, through conversation that can happen. For just speaking my mind, that can happen. I could offend somebody I can put myself in danger by speaking my mind, or I can, that's just the heart of just being, you know, for me, being an artist, if I weren't an artist, I still would be speaking my truth in some way.
Uh-huh. And I see that you are your art. That you are your art.
And I do. I actually use my own voice and my own body and very purposefully in my art. I focus the attention on me. I use memoir a lot in my writing, even when I'm speaking about other people. And that's purposeful for a number of different reasons. One is because I'm Black, I'm female, I'm middle-aged. And so I'm telling you as the listener, or the viewer, the watcher, the audience, I'm saying, look at this person and not as a compliment to what is white or what is male or what is young, but just look at this person.
Have you ever used those exact words in your art?
No.
Oh, those just shine. All the lights in the room are going on. You must remember what you just said.
Okay.
Look at this person, not in comparison to anything else, not other than, not as a compliment to. That is really something. And that's what your work's about.
Right? And you know, and I want to say something too, because I just realizing a connection, like when you ask me about that danger thing and the way that I use my own body and my own voice and the way that I use memoir is that I also try to judge myself. Because I mean, part of, you know, what I do as an artist is I am judging society. I'm judging, I'm making statements, I'm making, you know, so and so I try to put that, I try to turn it internal as well. And people are more, once I make myself more vulnerable, then people can enter the space with me more easily.
Well said. Well said. You are the tool of your own art, because you are the space. They have to enter your reality. They have to enter your soul. They have to enter your vision. That is said. You just said it. And because you began as a writer, and that's really the foundation of your work,
yeah.
I would like a closing piece of writing.
Okay.
Can I hear it?
Yes, yeah, so this is just something very brief, and it's the prelude to an upcoming childhood memoir. And but this particular prelude harkens back to something that you and I spoke a great deal about the last time we spoke, and that's that my relationship with my mother.
Do you want to give us a little context about that relationship?
Oh, well, it's good. It's positive. Okay, so my mother is an artist as well. She is also a multidisciplinary storyteller. She is, and I say that because she's a preacher, she's a minister, and she's a storyteller in that sense. And then she's also a writer. And then she also produces film. She produces much of my work. Mm-hmm. So she's a great lover of the arts. And I get my storytelling voice honest, I always say.
I would say there's plenty of DNA to go around there. Let's hear your work.
Okay, so it is every year and it is no year. And I am in bed listening to my mother tell me stories of her life on a farm in a flesh and bone place in North Carolina, south of Maryland, where I am. And in these stories, she is a child, like me, carrying her burdens and her joy and her pride and her people on her back. She tells me of the land and the women and the men and the children who never were children and were nothing but children, who were both in me and foreign to me, who gave birth to who I am. She tells me of tears that never run, but leave the salt of their dried up stain inside us all.
The voice of Pamela Wolford, and it is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production, post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Our funders are the Sinipet Fund, Natalie Canavore, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.